I'm Edward October, creator host of Octoberpod, and we're both listening to Freaky as Fuck on the Darkcast Network.
Darkcast Network. The light shines brightest on our indie podcasts.
Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of the Freaky as Fuck podcast. I'm your host, Sarai, and this is part two of the Gonzalez family massacre. Where we left off, authorities had started to notice some discrepancies in Seth's story. They'd also uncovered that he had a long history of being a pathological liar. Police were able to uncover that just before the murders of Teddy, Loiva, and Claudine Gonzalez, Seth had been exposed by his younger sister of falsifying university documents. He had been turning in his assignments late and had missed a number of his exams at Macquarie University. He was actually on the verge of failing his classes. He'd recently brought a girlfriend home for his parents to meet, but Teddy and Loiva were the least bit impressed by her. She was a couple years older than Seth, and they saw her as nothing more than a distraction from his studies. They told Seth that if he didn't break it off, they'd take away his beloved car. Along with the evidence against Seth, the possible motives were also beginning to pile up, but the most damning was the financial gain. Seth was in line to receive nearly $3 million from his family's estate, and he didn't wait long to try and receive this inheritance. He'd also received $15,000 from the government as part of a Victims of Crime program. He'd used that money on cosmetic enhancements for his mother's car, which he'd been driving since her murder. Seth vehemently denied ever having anything to do with the murder of his family. He said that it had to have been a hit put on by one of his father's business rivals, and that they purposefully left one member of the family alive to act as a scapegoat. The only reason police even entertained the idea that this was a contract killing was because a colleague of Teddy's once overheard him one day shouting at someone over the phone. This person said that it had taken him aback because this wasn't something Teddy did. It was extremely out of character for him. And when they asked if everything was all right, Teddy had stated that the person on the other end of that call told him that they were going to kill his family, but that he would handle it. Pretty compelling, right? Yeah, it would have been, except a month after the murders, Seth handed in an email that he'd received from an anonymous sender. It stated that a hitman was paid for the murder of three people, and that Seth was supposed to be one of the targets. Police were able to seize Seth's computer, and when they looked through it, they found a draft of this email. They also found that in the months leading up to the murders of Teddy, Loiva, and Claudine, searches were done for poisons that could easily be hidden in food. They were able to locate a proof of purchase of two seeds for two types of poisonous plants that were bought from a vendor in the U.S. and were delivered on June 29th. Police also uncovered an email from Seth to an Australian vendor who, at the time, wasn't taking online orders. The email asked the company if they could make an exception, as they were supposed to be a birthday present for his mother. In Seth's bedroom, taped to the underneath of his desk, police discovered a vial of some clear substance. Lab testing later proved that the substance was poison derived from one of the plants that was searched for on his computer. Just days before the murders, Loiva had been suffering with a high fever and severe abdominal pains. She was admitted to the hospital where she was diagnosed with colitis, which is inflammation of the inner lining of the colon, and it's sometimes associated with food poisoning. That's what Loiva believed it was, because Seth had told her that he too was having the same symptoms, and this was just after the family had eaten at a restaurant together. However, it seemed that this wasn't the case at all. Police took this as evidence that the murders of Teddy, Loiva, and Claudine were most definitely planned in advance. In September 2001, Seth announced to his extended family that he was diagnosed with a brain tumor. He asked his Aunt Annie, who was in charge of Teddy's foreign property investments, if she could hand over $190,000 out of his father's account to pay for a life-saving surgery. Immediately, Annie became suspicious and decided that not only was she not going to give him the money, but she was going to notify police as well. At the time, Seth had not received any money from the inheritance, and his second request for victim's compensation was denied. He was, however, able to amass around $88,000 from selling his car and pawning off his parents' possessions. Around this time, Seth had become acquainted with a man whom he had no idea was actually an undercover cop. The two had crossed paths at a coffee shop, and the man introduced himself as a gangster that had connections to the police. After the two had become more familiar with each other, the undercover cop admitted to Seth that he was well aware of the allegations against him and that he knew of a guy in prison that was on the verge of dying. He explained that this prisoner was willing to take the rap for crimes that he didn't commit and suggested to Seth that he could admit to killing his family. Seth provided his new friend with a hand-drawn floor plan of the Gonzalez's home and marked off where each member of the family was found and the times in which the attacks occurred, which was information that the police never made public. However, this would be the only information Seth would be willing to give up. He had ultimately decided not to take his new friend up on the offer, explaining that no one was really suspecting him because the murders were contract killings. Police were able to, however, compare Seth's handwriting with the racist graffiti that was left at the home, and of course, there were some slight similarities. January 2002, Seth still wasn't aware that he's been under police surveillance. However, they're getting trouble getting a confession out of him. The undercover cop tells Seth that the police are beginning to suspect him due to the many inconsistencies in his alibi. But rather than confess, Seth tells police a completely different alibi. He claimed to have actually left work just before 4 p.m. on July 10, 2001. He drove home, parked his car in the carport, and then walked to a nearby gas station where he called a taxi, which he took to a brothel where he was entertained by a prostitute. He admitted that the reason he hadn't told police this was because he was embarrassed and ashamed and he didn't want his family to find out. He claimed that when he'd left the brothel, he walked to a train station where he got another taxi that took him home and then immediately left to pick up Sam for their evening out. At this time, police were monitoring Seth's phone calls and they noticed that he had made numerous calls to different brothels all around the North Shore area. They noticed that he'd been in contact with an unidentified male as well. Authorities tracked down the man to get some information from him and found out that he was a local taxi driver. He claimed that on January 12th, Seth had approached him and offered him $50 for him to write a formal statement confirming that he had picked up Seth on the night of the murders. Police also spoke with the sex worker that Seth had supposedly visited with, and she revealed that she hadn't even been working that night. She also told authorities that Seth had been harassing her with over 100 text messages, trying to convince her to lie to the police about being with him on the night of July 10th. On May 30th, 2002, Seth reported to police that someone had broken into his apartment, but no evidence of the occurrence was ever uncovered. He told police that he'd also received two threatening emails, telling him to confess to the murders and warning him not to speak with reporters. The emails were traced back and it was determined that they were sent from an internet cafe in Sydney. Seth began charging reporters for interviews, claiming that it was putting him in danger and that he needed the money to hire protection for himself. However, after realizing that it might not be a good look to profit off the murders of his family, he did a free interview with a journalist for the Daily Telegraph newspaper. That night, Seth was found by a passerby laying in the street in the Sydney suburb of Chadswood. He was taken to the hospital, where he claimed he couldn't remember his name or what year it was, and was asking about his father. After supposedly regaining his memory, he stated that he was abducted while walking down the street. A car had pulled up and forced him inside, where a plastic bag was placed over his head. The assailants warned him to withdraw the $100,000 reward he had put up for any information regarding his family's murders, and then they hit him over the head with a plank of wood. However, he showed no signs of head trauma. On July 13th, 2002, police obtained a warrant to search Seth's apartment, and he was arrested on 3 counts of murder. His fingerprints were taken and ran through the system, and surprisingly, they get a hit. His fingerprints matched to an unidentified print police obtained from a letter that was sent to a food manufacturer. The letter claimed that some of their product had been poisoned, and this was received on July 2nd, 2001, the day after Loiva got sick with quote-unquote food poisoning. Coincidentally, the Australian Quarantine Inspection Service and the police received similar letters, supposedly from employees of this manufacturer. This was believed to be fabricated evidence from Seth's original plan to poison his family, planted in order to redirect suspicion away from himself. And because of this, he was also charged with threatening product contamination. This charge would be dropped if Seth was found guilty of murder, however. He was brought to the Silverwater Correctional Center, where he was denied bail due to being a flight risk. His trial began in April 2004, and on May 20th, the jury found him guilty of the triple homicide. He was given 3 life sentences, which would be served concurrently, with no possibility of parole, on September 18th, just 1 day after his 24th birthday. He's currently serving his term at Goulburn Correctional Center in New South Wales. In June 2007, it was found out that Seth had not been cautioned by police on the night of the murders, making any statements the police had taken from Seth that night inadmissible. I believe cautions are more of an English-Welsh thing, but basically, you can be given either a simple or a conditional caution in lieu of a conviction, and they're typically given to first-time offenders who are guilty of more low-level crimes. Whether a person is given a simple or conditional caution is determined on a case-by-case basis. In late November 2007, Seth's appeal was dismissed due to there being no evidence that a miscarriage of justice had taken place, and his conviction remained. Seth has tried multiple times to appeal this case since then, the most recent being in 2021, but all of his applications have been denied. The Gonzalez family home on Collins Street sold in October 2004. However, the buyers were never informed of the triple homicide that had taken place there. Apparently, during this time, it wasn't required for sellers to disclose this kind of information to their prospects. Well, the family who bought the home later found out about the murders, and the whole situation was publicized. The New South Wales government would actually later pass a law making it illegal to sell a home without disclosing that murders had taken place there, and the buyers were refunded their deposit on the house, and the real estate company was fined $21,000. From what I could tell, the house did wind up selling later on to people who were aware of its history. And that is all I have for you on the Gonzalez family massacre. What a clusterfuck of a case. Seth Gonzalez is a special kind of dipshit, I must say. How he believed he could get away with any of this is just beyond me, but I'm glad that he's now locked away forever, and I hope that the remaining Gonzalez family has found some peace, and may Teddy, Loiva, and Claudine never be forgotten. Before I leave you today, I wanted to end this episode with some interesting true crime news. For episode 22, I had covered the murders of sisters Amina and Sarah Saeed, who were shot by their father back in 2008. Well, the capital murder trial of Yasser Saeed began this week on August the 1st in Dallas, Texas. The jury was selected on Monday, and on Tuesday, Saeed entered a plea of not guilty. If convicted, he will receive an automatic life sentence with no possibility of parole for the killings of Amina and Sarah. More than 58 people are expected to testify, so it goes without saying that I most definitely will be following this trial. I hope the jury does right by Amina and Sarah because they deserve every morsel of justice. These girls were so young, and they absolutely did not deserve to have their lives snuffed out so early. Yasser Saeed deserves to rot in prison. On a bit of a lighter note, I wanted to share with y'all something that I have been so invested in lately, and I feel like some of y'all might get a kick out of it too. On TikTok, there is a user by the name of Stay Golden Pony Boy who claims that they're attached to a ghost that they refer to as Chad. Stay Golden Pony Boy, whose real name is Liv, by the way, said on one of their TikToks that they've been attached to this ghost for about 4 to 5 years, and this year they decided to purchase a set of dowsing rods in order to communicate with their spirit friend. If you're not familiar with what dowsing rods are, they're these L-shaped rods that are used for many things, not just for communicating with spirits. But in this case, Liv uses her dowsing rods by holding each one in her hands and asking Chad yes or no questions. And based on Chad's answers, the rods will either stay still or they will cross to answer the question. She begins each TikTok by asking Chad to establish what a yes answer looks like, and then they go on to ask Chad, who was a frat boy that attended the University of Florida, some random hilarious questions like whether he's an ass or a boob guy, or if he's an LGBTQ+ ally. And as the series goes on, Stay Golden Pony Boy gets a spirit box for Chad to better communicate, and I'm fully invested. This is the kind of content that I need in my life, and every week I look forward to learning more about our boy Chad, who 100% seems like the coolest fucking dude. I'll have Liv's TikTok linked in the show notes so that y'all can get to know him as well. But yeah, that's all I have for you today. If you enjoyed this episode, please do me a solid by rating it 5 stars and leaving a nice little review on your favorite podcast listening platform. If you have the means to support the show further, you can make a donation to our coffee or buy yourself something nice from our merch store. And I'll have links to both places in the show notes, but you can also find them on our website, www.freakyafpodcast.com. You can connect with me on Twitter and Instagram as well, at freakyafpod, or shoot me an email at freakyafpodcast@gmail.com. I hope to have you all here back next week, but until then, stay spooky, bitches. Bye!
Network. The light shines brightest on our indie podcasts.
Hey there, Rainbow Warriors. I'm CJ, host of Beyond the Rainbow, True Crimes of the LGBT. My episodes focus on crimes committed by and against the LGBTQ community. I've covered cases you probably have heard of, such as Matthew Shepard, Brandon Tina, and the Orlando Pulse nightclub massacre, as well as some lesser-known cases like the murder of Ray Hainish, the Australian Gay Beat murders, and the suspicious disappearance of Lisa Lynn Stone. I cover cases brought to me by listeners like Penny Brummer, who I believe was wrongfully convicted, taboo cases such as lesbian corrective rape and murder in South Africa, and Pray the Gay Away camps. I discuss gay serial killers, women who pretend to be men to hook up with other women, and trans murders. I'm opinionated and uncensored. I know I'm not everyone's cup of tea, but surely I'm someone's shot at tequila. No matter what your gender or orientation in life might be, please join me as I tackle rainbow crimes in search of unicorn justice. Remember, it's not a crime to be gay, unless you're a murderer.